I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama has lifted off for a trip to Asia, leaving behind a homework assignment. He's asked for new plans for Afghanistan, reflecting a clearer exit strategy and timeline. This week, the U.S. ambassador in Afghanistan reportedly made a strong case in cables and in conversation with the president against more combat troops for Afghanistan. So who has the president's ear? Washington Post national security reporter Greg Jaffe joins us from the Pentagon. And Greg, there was reporting earlier this week that the president, choosing from four plans, was going with a 30,000 troop increase, less than the 40,000 increase General McChrystal asked for, but more than the 10,000 increase in the smaller plan. Do we know what happened this week?
Well, I think he got four plans. I think what he didn't get that he'd like is a better sense of what the U.S. government is going to do in sort of the non-military areas. What are we doing to build governance? What are we doing to focus on development? The things that need to happen so we have a credible Afghan partner that we can hand this country off to.
And what was the effect, from what you know, of the cables and the conversation with Ambassador Carl Eikenberry?
Well, I think Eikenberry essentially said, hey, look, before we push more troops in here, we need to make sure we've got a credible partner that we're working with in the Afghan government. Because if you're transitioning to an Afghan government that's corrupt, and has a different sort of goal than you do, you're moving in the wrong direction. So that was Eikenberry's concern. I mean, the other big concern that Eikenberry had is it's not widely known, but earlier this summer in August, he asked for $2.5 billion more in terms of reconstruction, development, governance aid to Afghanistan that he didn't get. And I think there's some frustration on his part that, you know, we're on the verge of spending, you know, for 30,000 additional troops, an extra $30 billion a year, but he can't seem to get an additional $2.5 billion for what everybody says is the really critical effort here, which is building a competent Afghan government.
Well, as you say, the concerns about funding may not have been known, but certainly the president and his advisors know about the concerns about corruption in the Karzai government in Afghanistan. So is there a sense of something else that Eikenberry might have said to President Obama to make him reject all four of these proposals?
Well, I think the first thing that Eikenberry said clearly is that, hey, we don't have a balanced, we don't have a clear path forward in terms of how we're going to address the governance problems in Afghanistan. I think the other thing is, you know, the elections, which were a while ago, certainly raised doubts about the Karzai government. And then most recently, I think Karzai did an interview with Margaret Warner on the NewsHour and said some things that gave senior U.S. officials pause about whether, hey, this guy was really committed to the way forward that they envisioned for the country.
Well, primarily, Karzai told PBS, the West has little interest in Afghanistan. They're just there for self-serving reasons to fight terrorism. That could not have gone over very well with the White House.
No, I think it raised doubts among the White House about whether his commitment to working with the U.S., to sort of weeding out corruption, to sort of building a reasonably representative government that's functional.
Greg, your quick thoughts on speculation that the president is now considering a low troop force, but also using the troops mostly as advisors.
I'm skeptical of that. The Pentagon and the military commanders are pretty united in their feeling that they need at least 30,000 troops to do a sort of a comprehensive counterinsurgency strategy. I think if the president decides to go with something less, I think the military's feeling is that he's going to have to change the mission in Afghanistan.
So you're saying that the thinking still is that there might be 30,000 or so troops, but he wants a better exit plan? He wants it more defined?
Right. I mean, right now they're saying 30,000 troops for 3 to 5 years is what McChrystal and the Pentagon have sort of been saying, which is a long period of time. So I think he wants a more clearly defined exit strategy. And I think even more important, he wants to make sure that, you know, we're pursuing a balanced strategy.
Well, and we should mention that pundits in the U.S. are split on the direction ahead. You have conservative George Will, one of the biggest proponents of pulling out entirely. But we wondered, from your front row seat, Greg, how much is the president's recent interaction with the military, his visit to Dover Air Force Base to see returning remains, his visits to Arlington National Cemetery, to Fort Hood, how much might this be affecting his decision-making on Afghanistan, or do you think that's something for future biographers?
I think it is affecting his decision-making. You remember early in the spring, he sent 21,000 more troops to Afghanistan. I don't think he really was as engaged as he is this time. You know, he had a lot of things on his plate in terms of the economic recovery and stimulus package and stuff like that. Now I think he's really focused on this issue and the weight of being commander-in-chief, the weight of, you know, sending people off to a war in which many might die or many will die. is a huge responsibility. And I think one of the things he's wrestling with, and we see these trips to Dover and Hood, is that, you know, it's become very real for him.
That's Washington Post national security reporter Greg Jaffe from the Pentagon. He's also co-author of the recently released book, The Fourth Star. Greg, thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Well, we want to spend a few minutes today on a problem commonly discussed about women, but becoming more common among men. In fact, Dr. James Glazer of the Maine Medical Center says he's increasingly seeing problematic eating behavior in men, specifically men who are recreational cyclists or triathletes or Nordic skiers, who notice their performances improve after losing a few pounds. But these are guys, not women, so problems are often overlooked or denied. Well, now a top runner is speaking out about his struggle with anorexia, and we're going to spend some time with him today. David Proctor graduated from Boston University last year. He's the only BU runner to break the four-minute mile, and as a native of Britain, he's a strong candidate for Britain's 2012 Olympic team. David, welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Paula Quattromoni, Associate Professor of Nutrition at Boston University, who counseled David when he realized he needed to do something. Paula, welcome to you as
well.
Thank you. So, David, just talk us through. How did it start for you? You were a terrific runner. I understand, you know, maybe somebody unknowingly said something to you.
Yeah. I mean, in high school, I think I was very much running on natural talent. And when I came to BU and realized it took a bit more than just natural talent to do well, this just seemed, you know, logically like the next thing I need to pay more attention to. I never paid attention to what I ate when I was growing up. Mm. And comments here and there that I think were made very innocently at first just kind of took a little bit of a toll on me. And I,
Like what?
Just the way guys kind of interact, like in the locker room, coaches and stuff, and will throw out comments like, you know, you're getting a little bit overweight, or you're getting a bit fat there, enjoying that American diet, are you not? Those kind of things. So
well, that might pass right over somebody else, but we hear this too with, you know, girls who are gymnasts or on swim teams. Somebody just says, "Hey, you're putting on a few pounds," and boom, what happens? What happened to you when your coach said that to you?
It was almost kind of like an attack on my commitment and my dedication to what I wanted to do. Like, I came out here with a dream, obviously, and I wanted to do the very best that I could do, and I think that it just seemed like, you know, to say that kind of thing to me was almost like saying you're failing in your job, in your the responsibilities that you have. I think that it was just seemed like something that I needed to try and grab control of and make sure that I was doing everything I could.
And it was overnight. I mean, you literally got up the next day and said, I'm losing weight. What did you do?
That's exactly how my personality is. I'm very like, I do like to do everything to the best of my ability or not at all. Like, I'm definitely all or nothing. So if I just wanted to make that change as soon as possible.
And you were what, monitoring what you were eating, allowing yourself only to eat at certain times? What kind of behavior?
It was more complete at first, you know, like I would cut everything out and eat as little as I possibly could. I think it was somewhere around 20 pounds in the first 2 weeks, just because I took it so seriously. I just cut everything out and I exercised more than I ever did before. I wanted to please everyone. I wanted to make sure that I was doing my job. And we
should rush to say, you were an elite runner. It's not like you had a lot to lose, you know?
So
how thin did you get?
I think I made it down to about 130, 135 pounds, something like that.
And you're almost 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
That's not good.
I was small.
And yet, what did you start to notice about your running?
It was improving.
Darn.
Yeah, I know.
Because isn't that, you know, that's what sort of masked a problem, right?
It would get to that point where I'd walk down the street and everything would look attractive. I'd want to eat everything. But I had an internal will. Like, the desire to improve my performance, lose my weight, you know, get my coach's approval was a lot more important to me than my own kind of satisfaction with food.
So how did it go from, you know, your running's improving and you're losing weight, mm-hmm, to realizing there's a problem here?
I always kind of thought about it as like, I could stop this whenever I wanted to. I'm just doing it to lose weight. So I get to the right point where my coach is like saying, you know, you can run fast now, you'll do well. And once I get there, I'll stop and I'll be fine. And when it got to the point where I was like, well, okay, I'm at this weight, what would happen if I just lost like another one? Would I go faster? And then I'd get there and he'd be like, well, maybe I can just lose another one. And that's when you kind of spiral out of control.
So before we get to Paula, just one last question. At this point when you're so thin, 130 at almost 6, is anyone saying anything to you or any coaches or friends saying, hey, I think, you know, had anyone pointing out you might have a problem?
Yeah. I mean, there were girls on the team who were dealing with the same thing. I was close friends with them, and they would, you know, I guess bravely for them, not attack me about it, but, you know, just ask if everything was going okay, and I'd take it on board. But I was willing to sacrifice my friendships for my success, and I wanted to do as best as I could, and if I had to lose some friends along the way, that's how it would have to be.
Paula Quattromoni, you began working with David. How many male athletes do you think have this issue?
The statistics are all over the place. The estimates are that of the people with eating disorders, only about 5 to 15% are male. And again, even the statistics for anorexia, 0.5 to 1% of the population. But those are huge underestimates because they only reflect people who come for treatment. And this really is a silent disease. A lot of people struggle with the psychological aspects of eating disorders and, of course, the food behaviors, but don't necessarily reach clinical criteria where it's as observable that their weight is so low or that they're binging and purging with enough frequency to meet the diagnostic criteria or someone who might go for help.
And we should say, we've long heard about, say, wrestlers who starve themselves to meet weight. But this isn't that. That's sort of an acute thing. It's a problem, but you're not talking about that. This is a chronic, it becomes 24 hours a day.
Yes, it takes over the individual's life. In fact, most people, when they're ready to get into treatment and break away from the denial, it's usually because they are exhausted by this disorder. It has taken over their life. They think about food 24/7. They can't sleep at night. They are constantly judging themselves, you know, very harshly over what they ate, what they're strategizing over when they'll allow themselves to have their next meal, focusing on the numbers, weighing themselves a dozen times a day. It's exhausting.
That, David, that's what you were saying was happening to you. You'd walk down the street and it was just everything you saw you wanted to eat. And,
yeah. I mean, the point where I completely lost control was when I remember lying on my bed and I hadn't eaten a thing all day, but I had run 12 miles and I couldn't wait until exactly 6 o'clock until I could eat dinner. I couldn't eat dinner before 6 o'clock. I had to wait until exactly 6 o'clock. It was at that point I thought, I'm making some kind of mistake. This can't be right. I can't be doing this anymore.
That's elite runner David Proctor talking about his struggle with anorexia. Boston University nutrition professor Paula Quattromoni is also joining us. When we come back, is this you? If it is, we'll find out what to do about it. Also later today, breaking the stigma for tough troops in Iraq who need mental health help. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about eating disorders in male athletes with 24-year-old runner David Proctor, who hopes to make it onto Britain's 2012 Olympic team, and Paula Quattromoni, a Boston University nutrition professor. Continuing our story, David suffered tremendous emotional and physical consequences from anorexia, but also injuries that sidelined his career, and after all, we know this can be fatal. We know about the heart failure in Karen Carpenter. So David went through nutrition counseling and therapy. Paula, that's where you came in. Now, you call eating disorders maladaptive coping mechanisms. Why?
Sure. Well, nutrition is in diet and food behavior is the way it plays out, but perceptions of self, body image, control. I mean, there are a lot of other mental health diagnoses that tend to coexist with eating disorders like obsessive compulsive disorders or anxiety, depression. So that is a huge crux of the treatment and therapy, is to get some mental health support, and psychotherapy is a big part of it.
And do we know, is there some sort of genetic tripwire?
There is a genetic link. But there's also a huge environmental component. And it's also not uncommon for people to have grown up in environments where there's either a lot of family dysfunction, maybe a mother had an eating disorder.
Then you say that it can also be contagious in groups. So teams and, you know, athletes who work together can catch it almost.
In terms of the modeling of behavior and the norms as to what is acceptable behavior.
So what did you start doing with David?
Well, when we first met,
big smile.
And when I know we have a very wonderful working relationship. But when we first met, and David came up to me after I gave a lecture for the entire track team, and he came up to me and said, "I would really like your help. I'd like to come see you for one-on-one consultations." He said, "Because I need to lose some weight." And I was really taken aback because looking at him, I thought for sure he was going to say, "Because I need to gain some weight." So
I knew
immediately where we needed to go. So we started working together in December of his freshman year. And it took quite a while to build the trust of that working relationship. And after about 5 months of working together on the nutrition, he was ready to start working with sports psychology. And so we added that on as the next step.
And what did you learn, David, when she says nutrition?
I didn't know anything about nutrition, how it affected me as an athlete, or, you know, what I needed to recover from runs and or fuel myself, basically. So I think the biggest thing I learned through working with Paula was just kind of, you know, how food is an ally, basically.
Well, and it sounds like that also gave you that feeling that you were craving of being able to manage it.
Yeah. Oh, it was. And I think
he knew how to eat it, right?
Yeah, it was great in a way that I can kind of not lose the control but shift the control somewhere else so that I know, you know, knowledge is power, basically. And, and I chose initially to use it to the negative and cut certain things out. And once I knew what I was doing, I could help it and make it a bit more positive.
And how do you feel now about an eating disorder? Is it something that you are keeping at bay? Is it something that you're going to have to think about the rest of your life? Or is it a phase that's going to be behind you? What?
Just because it was something that was in my head, I think it's always going to be there. But I'm definitely becomes more about which you choose to listen to and how you choose to, you know, the choices you make, basically. And, you know, I have a list of things that I make sure that I need this to stay healthy. I've got to get my five a day.
Five fruits and vegetables,
yeah. But I think it's always going to be there. It's always a thought that's in the back of your mind because you're always, it's something that took over your life, basically. And I think it's just, I have the maturity now and I wouldn't change it for the world because, like I said, I think it's a good education and it's something that's helped me grow and develop. And I know so much about it now that I've got a story to share, you know?
Well, and I was going to ask about that. Is that kind of tough to do? You know, this was supposed to be a women's issue, eating disorders, and here you are, you know, potential Olympic athlete here. You know, is it hard for you to do that, to share it?
There is a stigma attached to it, but I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of. If I can help someone and stop them going through what I went through.
And do you see it in other guys?
Yeah, but I don't think they're as willing to kind of talk about it. I think it's a lot more natural for guys to be able to eat whatever they want and still be 6 feet and 120 pounds, you know, and sometimes you might think they have a problem when they actually don't. I think it's when things start to, if their performance is suffering because they're making a conscious effort to avoid eating something or you know, take control of their diet, then that's when it becomes a problem. And if I see it as being a problem, I do everything I can to talk to them and tell them my experiences and if possible forward them onto someone who might have more experience with helping them out.
And by the way, Paula, you've said there's a difference between an eating disorder and disordered eating. Just go over that. What's the difference?
Sure. I think when I first met David, I would put him in the category of, he definitely had eating disordered behaviors in place. That was in December. I had to work really hard to get him back to see me. He came back. It was the end of March. And by then, those eating disorder behaviors were set. They were really becoming ingrained for him.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that once these behaviors become very ingrained, it's much more difficult to break.
And what's the trend in college sports when it comes to handling these disorders? Are colleges doing what you're doing, you know, working with the kids?
There is a tremendous amount of awareness building going on. More and more people are willing to talk about it. More and more people in universities are willing to invest resources. So
even when it comes to guys?
Yes, I think much more recognition than there ever has been in the past.
And David, one last question to you. What about the coaches? You know, because especially male sports, there's sort of a macho, buck-up kind of attitude. Are coaches accepting that boys, young men, have problems?
Yeah, I think they are. I just do want to say, like, I know we've kind of said that how I first initially got this problem was the coach coming over and making an offhanded comment. But I do want to say that my coach, Bruce, is, he was one of the greatest support systems I had in place at the time. He's my hero. He took it very seriously and he did everything he could to help me out. They forwarded me onto the right people. And I think it was good that my path crossed with Paula's because it obviously turned everything around and changed everything for the better.
Paula is Paula Quattromoni, Associate Professor of Nutrition at Boston University. And that's David Proctor, a client of Paula's, but also someone who hopes to be running on Britain's 2012 Olympic track team. David, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
And of course, if there is a 2012 ahead on the program, I'll look at the new film that says there's not going to be. And tomorrow in Here and Now, remembering the British pirate radio DJs in the 60s, we'll hear from two of them. That's tomorrow. Back after the latest news, Here and Now. Australia is in the grip of Tiger mania, Tiger Woods, that is, the world's greatest golfer, and he definitely lived up to the hype today, playing before an enormous gallery in the Australian Masters Tournament. Woods fired a score of 66, 6 under par, and he's tied for the lead. This is the first time Tiger Woods has played down under in more than a decade, and his return is being treated like a visit from the Queen, but not everyone is thrilled. $3 million in money from Australian taxpayers was used to entice Tiger to come back, and some are wondering, was it well spent? The BBC's Nick Bryant reports from Melbourne.
11 years of waiting, and finally it's Tiger time.
From the moment that Tiger Woods touched down in his private plane, he's been in the eye of a media storm. News choppers hovered overhead, journalists crowded in on him below.
He was certainly dressed for Melbourne's heatwave, shorts, shirt, and a baseball cap.
Where they watched, snapped, and filmed his every move. From an early morning practice round.
Well, Tiger Woods is the best golfer in the world, and he didn't get there by sleeping in.
To chance encounters with fellow guests in his hotel gym.
I said, g'day, mate. He said, what's happening? And I asked him for a photo, and he said, later on, mate.
It's Tiger's first visit to Australia in 11 years, and it has the look and feel of a royal and presidential visit, all rolled into one. It's taken the world's highest-paid sportsman by surprise.
Tiger, well, again, welcome to Melbourne. I mean, even this media conference is going live around Australia on the Nine Network. Is this normal, this sort of reception?
No, it's not normal. No, trust me, it's not. No, thank God it's not normal.
I've come out to the championship course where the cars are bumper to bumper. I guess you could call it a Tiger Jam. And there's a long queue of golf fans, their faces daubed with protective zinc cream. It's a sellout for 4 days. The organisers have sold over 100,000 tickets. And from an economic perspective, Tiger Woods has become something of a one-man stimulus package.
And Tiger, welcome. We wish you the best for this week.
Thank you.
Taxpayers have footed much of the bill for his $3 million appearance fee. It's over 10 times the prize money for winning the tournament. But the Premier of Victoria, John Brumby, claims he's worth every cent.
We estimated the economic impact of this event would be $19 million. I'm happy to say with the sellout that we've experienced, we've got hotels full, we've got motels full, we've got restaurants that are booked out. We estimate that the economic benefit of this event will comfortably exceed the $19 million that we calculated.
Tiger Woods is a billionaire. Does he really need $3 million appearance money to come to Australia? What a joke.
Richard Moore, the head of the Melbourne International Film Festival. Millions have been lavished on Tiger's visit, while the local arts community always struggles for funding.
I mean, if I say it, I mean, I sound like a moaning sort of arts whiner who doesn't get enough money. I mean, the arts are always in that sort of position.
And presumably, you could finance a movie with that kind of money.
For $3 million, you could probably finance, at this stage, 3 Australian movies. I think it's obscene, to tell you the truth.
But it's a worthwhile investment, according to Greg Highwood, the chief executive of Tourism Victoria. Melbourne is trying to position itself as a global golfing destination, much like Scotland or Ireland. Tiger Woods is its temporary salesman.
It's all about a broader strategy a broader strategy to get people to come here and play golf, and even beyond that, a broader strategy to make sure that people understand that Melbourne is a great place to visit.
As an added bonus, Melbourne beat its long-standing rival, Sydney, to attract Tiger to this course. And it's hard to put a price tag on something as special as that.
The BBC's Nick Bryant reporting from Melbourne, Australia. And a note about tomorrow's show. Best-selling author Mike Lupica will be here. His new book for young readers is called Million Dollar Throw. It features a teenage quarterback named Nate Brody who wins the chance of a lifetime to win $1 million with a perfect pass, but he faces some hurdles along the way.
If you start reading one of my books, you almost know that it's not going to be smooth sailing for the main character. He's going to have to get through stuff.
Speaking of which, a shout-out to my nephew Zoli. He just broke his collarbone playing high school football while in the emergency room. His quarterback, Johnny, came in having broken his arm. If it's any consolation, guys, this is a terrific book from Mike Lupica about high school football. I don't think it is much consolation, but as he says, there is always tough sailing. Oh, so sorry about that. Back in a minute, here and now. Fort Hood, the scene of last week's shooting rampage, has lost hundreds of soldiers in combat in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the base also has one of the highest suicide rates of any U.S. military base. At least 10 Fort Hood soldiers have killed themselves this year, second only to Kentucky's Fort Campbell, with 16 suicides in 2009. The Army's taken steps to deal with all of this, but as we've often said here, a big hurdle is the stigma associated with getting help.
When I discovered 3 years ago that I was diagnosed with clinical depression, I was embarrassed, humiliated. I also came to understand that there's a tremendous stigma surrounding any kind of brain disease. I want to make a movie about this.
That's actor Joey Pantoliano, Joey Pants, you may know him from The Sopranos. And he made that film. It's called No Kidding, Me Too. Dr. Robert Irvin is featured in the film. He's a psychiatrist at McLean Hospital here in the Boston area. He's also just back from a trip to Iraq with Joey as part of this effort to reduce the stigma that comes with admitting you need mental health care. We asked Dr. Irvin to come tell us more about what he found. He did. Now, Bob, you didn't go to treat soldiers. Why did you go?
We went, really, as the mission was stated, to stomp the stigma of mental illness. Joey is very committed to this issue, and also the troops. As a friend of his, he called me up to be the psychiatric representative on the team. It was a team that was comprised of Joey, myself, and another actress, Lisa Jay, and we showed his documentary, The Troops, and tried to help them seek help.
Well, and I should say, because I'm sitting here with you, you're a youngish, kind of hippish-looking guy, and of course Joey is Joey Pants.
He is Joey Pants.
Is that part of it, that it has to be someone like a Joey Pants?
When you see somebody in the movies or, you know, on a sports field and you have a certain vision of them as, you know, having a public image and a persona, then having somebody speak openly about that, I think it does reduce some of the resistance to actually going and talking about it.
Well, he's also got some, let's say, rough edges. And we're understanding, because of, you know, some fabulous reporting from NPR's Daniel Swerdling and others, that one of the problems up to even 2 years ago was that especially the older soldiers, the ones who were in charge, would often literally berate soldiers who said that they were having mental health problems. So to see someone who is kind of a tough guy admit that he has a problem, that's got to have an impact.
Having that tough guy persona in a culture where toughness is obviously exemplified as a pretty serious virtue and oftentimes necessity, it does make it a little bit easier.
So again, you didn't treat troops, but you listened to them. What did they say?
Many of the soldiers that are there are more worried, actually, about some of the things that they have to face when they return than even the issues of combat.
Well, what were the ones they were thinking they were going to face? Would girlfriends be there? Would bills be there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think this war is very different than any other in that our communication systems have rapidly transformed over the course of the past decade. So you can be in theater and having just been in a firefight and be on a computer Skyping home and talking to your wife or husband and seeing your kids in your living room right after having experienced combat. And the issues at home don't go away.
I was thinking, well, that would be a good thing that you could immediately see a loved one, but maybe it's also jarring.
I think it's a double-edged sword. It really is.
What did you observe Joey Pants say to guys and guys and women say back to him? What were those interactions like?
Well, you know, he's a celebrity, and that's for sure. I mean, a lot of it, I think, was literally just signing autographs and being a celebrity. But He's also a pretty remarkably sensitive guy as well, and he has a good ear. And actually, you know, one of the soldiers that we talked to for the first time talked about, you know, his own suicide attempt and had not previously talked about that with anybody else before. And, you know, Joey pounded on my bunk, and he's like, hey, Doc, you got to get over here. You know, this is serious. But, you know, we were able to assist that guy and get him to some help.
Well, you know, and it's one thing, Joey Pants, I think it's, you know, it's a noble thing that he's done, but Joey Pants gets a movie that he enters into the film festivals, he gets to go home, he's dealing with depression, no laughing matter, but those guys stay behind. You know, is there ever a sense of, you sort of sprinkle some fairy dust and then go on a trip like this?
I don't have any beliefs that we even sprinkled fairy dust, and you actually bring up a really important point that I experienced firsthand, and that was leaving the different camps, you know, in a Black Hawk and, you know, looking at these people that really put their lives on the line to protect us while there, and thinking, you know, okay, fine, you know, I listened to their story for an hour or two, and I'm gone. There was a certain sense of helplessness on my part in realizing how little I could actually do for that particular individual in that instance. In order to kind of transform that, you know, now really being given an opportunity like this is to have a larger voice and try to do what we can for them when they do get home. And it's going to take civilian mental health professionals in addition to those within the VA system to be able to handle this, because there's an overflow of need.
Well, I just want to get your thoughts on that. Again, it would just be your opinion, but we're, of course, speaking in the aftermath of the Fort Hood incident. And when the shooting first occurred, the alleged shooter, psychiatrist in the military, a lot of stories came out about how psychiatrists treating combat veterans can also almost catch PTSD from hearing story after story after story. Now, since it's kind of, you know, been discounted that this might have played a role with Major Hassan as much, but there are stories of other psychiatrists who have been treating seriously injured and ill soldiers just getting completely burned out as the Army is frantically trying to train more and more to send them into combat, to send them into theater at places like the University of Pennsylvania. You know, your sense of that, of, you know, quickly ramping up psychiatrists.
In terms of the fact that this particular individual was a psychiatrist, my fear was that the fact that he was would somehow deter others from seeking help. You know, anything that puts a mark of stigma, you know, on, you know, mental health or mental health services, it certainly doesn't help.
I just have to say that's so interesting, because you're looking at it through your prism. The prism that most people looked at that was, if they feared at all, it was fear that it would reflect poorly on Muslims. That's been the national dialogue. You were watching it as
a psychiatrist. Yeah.
And thinking it would reflect on you, but tell me more.
If somebody was, you know, sitting or wrestling with their problem and they were on the fence and they are, you know, a soldier in uniform and they see somebody that they would be thinking about going, you know, to seek help from is now an alleged, you know, mass murderer, that's not going to help them get there. Mm-hmm. You know, in mental health professionals, I think, certainly in the civilian world, we have peer supervision because, you know, hearing, you know, the stories that we do and the way that we have to in order to be empathic and connect can take its toll. But we're trained how to deal with that, and we have peers to help us with those kinds of things. In terms of the military, I have to say I really have no knowledge of the kind of support systems that they have in place.
Right. But, of course, we all saw, what's the show? Oh, The Sopranos, of course, where the psychiatrist had a psychiatrist that she had to go to. Of course, back to The Sopranos. That's Dr. Robert Irvin, featured in a film made by Joey Pantoliano of The Sopranos fame. He made a documentary about the stigma attached to mental health issues. It's called No Kidding Me Too. Dr. Irvin, thanks so much for talking to us about your trip to Iraq with him.
Sure.
Remember those Y2K theories? Well, 2000 came and went, and now doomsayers have fixated on a new date, December 21st, 2012. That's when the over 5,000-year Mayan calendar finally resets. And it's also the day the December solstice aligns with the galactic plane. What could that mean?
This mass suicide was discovered here in the ancient Mayan city of Tikal. The victims adhere to the Mayan calendar, which predicts that the end of time will coincide with a planetary alignment on the 21st of December of 2012.
Hello?
Kate, I've rented a plane. Pack up the kids.
The governor just said we're fine now.
You call me back when you calm down.
It seems the worst is over.
Oh, no, it's not over. That's the sound of California falling into the ocean. Later, meteors will disintegrate whole cities in the film 2012, which starts tomorrow. Are the Y-12ers, as they're being called, right? Or is this, as our next guest says, a lot of cosmic rigmarole? Anthony Avini is an astronomy and anthropology professor at Colgate University. His new book is The End of Time, The Maya Mystery of 2012. Tony, welcome.
Well, nice to be here, Robin.
And you say cosmic rigmarole, but with just enough science and cultural underpinnings to get people on board?
Well, I think the positions taken by some of the Y-12ers is based on this kind of received wisdom that has nothing to do with studying and understanding the culture in depth. I'm excited to see the movie, though. I think it's going to top Apocalypto.
Well, it'll get people interested in the Mayans, which will be good. Let's start with what you believe they actually did know and say. The date, December 21st, 2012. What does that signify in the Mayan calendar?
Well, the Maya built cycle upon cycle to create their calendars. They started out with units based on 20, the number of fingers and toes on the human body, built it up to 260, the number of days in the human gestation period, and then built and built and built until they created a long count. It's all going to close and reopen, as you correctly said at the outset. It's not the end of time. It's rather the beginning of a new cycle on the 21st of December in the year 2012.
Well, and so, as you say, it is true that there is a new cycle starting on December 21st, 2012. There's no question about that. But they viewed it, as you say, as the start of another chapter. You say that this is peculiar to Americans in particular, that, you know, goes back to the Puritans. We have this sense of apocalypse that maybe the Mayans didn't.
One thing about we Americans is we take our religion very seriously. And we are very fatalistically directed, I think, from this early Christian seed that was planted in us back in the Great Awakening and the Puritan colonies, this idea that the end is near. And of course, just a few years ago, you'll remember with the occurrence of the comet Hale-Bopp, there was a cult group that thought the comet was coming to take them into the hereafter. So it's a peculiarly American phenomenon, I think.
Well, but in addition to the Y-12ers, who believe that there will be apocalypse on 2012. And let's face it, the people in Hollywood who are selling a movie, you know, based on that thinking. There are Y-12ers who believe that this date will be some sort of cosmic awakening.
Yeah, isn't it interesting, Robin, that it's either a blow-up or a bliss-out? There never seems to be any in-between for us. Well, if it's not going to be the end of the world, then maybe there'll be a cosmic convergence, a coming together of celestial bodies that will somehow propel us to a new age of awareness. This is a very common idea, and you can at least trace it back to 1987. And I think you and I are old enough to remember the cosmic convergence proposed by Jose Arguelles when one of the cycles of the Aztec calendar would come together.
Was this the harmonic convergence?
Oh, it sure was. And there were people who were holding hands all around the world in different places to await this deliverance.
Tony, I just have to jump in and say that I had the misfortune of having a long-planned trip to Machu Picchu in Peru, you know, a week-long hike, and arrived at Machu Picchu, this incredibly spiritual place, as busloads of New Yorkers rolled up looking for the harmonic convergence.
Yeah, well, I think you'll see something similar. I've already been invited to a star party at Copan and another one at Tikal. So there will be people out there awaiting the moment. And of course, whenever we turn the clock through a cycle, there is this moment when we want to turn over a new leaf. I mean, we can think of New Year's Eve as a good example. So I think this whole idea of the re-beginning, the rebirth of ourselves is always conceived in a cyclic way. How will we make things better? How will we take action? But what I don't like about Shift Happens, great parody on an old bumper sticker, is that it's fatalistic. And I think that we need to pay some attention to this American fatalism, this notion that things happen to us and there's nothing we can do about it.
Well, a couple questions, though, Professor. Shift Happens. The Mayans are gone.
Well, there are some 2 million of them alive and well in Yucatan, speaking 29 different dialects of Maya language. What happened to the Maya is that they just got out of building big buildings and having a long count calendar and a sophisticated system of hieroglyphic writing. And I think that's why we romance them. We look at them and we see this science and mathematics and precision, and we say, why, they're like us. So we admire them. But then I think sometimes we read too much into that.
Well, what about another thing that Y-12ers hold up as proof that Mayans did think the end of the world would come when their calendar reset this coming December. It's the last page of the Dresden Codex. This is a Maya bark paper book from the 14th century, and it appears to show destruction by flood. And they hold that up and say, see, the Mayans had this, what you would call this fatalistic view.
Well, Dresden 74, as we call it, is certainly destruction by deluge. It does appear on the last page, so that's fitting. And it shows deities and serpents in the sky gushing water from heaven. I think most people who've studied that document read it as metaphor. These are, if you will, symbolic warnings given to us about how we ought to try to reconceive and redirect our lives. They are not absolute predictions that transcend time. To put it simply, the Maya message is not intended for us. It's intended for the Maya. And if a Maya priest could rise from his grave, he might say to us, go get your own 0 point. Don't bother with ours.
Well, in fact, there are Mayans, you know, who've survived, as you've said. What do the living Mayans think about all this hoo-ha? What are they going to do on 2012?
I asked one of our guides down there. I take Colgate students down to this area every year, and we do off-campus study. And I asked him what's going to happen. And he gave me the response I actually anticipated, and it fits with what you see in the documents. He said, well, hopefully a new era of peace in the world will happen and we'll have a better world. And this is what we always look forward to at the end of any cycle, whether it be a millennium or a century or a New Year's or even Sunday night when we want to make the week. We have to dread that Monday morning, but we want to make it a better week than it was last week.
That's a big calendar, though, 5,000 or so years. That's Anthony Avini, an astronomy and anthropology professor at Colgate University. His new book is The End of Time, The Maya Mystery of 2012. Tony, professor, thank you so much.
Nice to talk to you, Robin. Bye.
Well, the end of the world is also a good theme for a song. Here's a sample.
I know the end is near. I've seen the warning signs. Been preparing myself, laying in supplies.
When the end of the world finally comes, there'll be no one to listen. All my words will erase what I've made of my existence.
I wanna say it hurts in the end of the world.
To see pictures of the adventures we mentioned at Tikal and Machu Picchu, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it.